When the Panama Canal was completed over 100 years ago, it revolutionised international maritime trade by massively reducing the amount of time it took for ships to travel between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. And in June this year, a big upgrade was opened. For 2 years now, Nicaragua, which sits to the north of Panama, has been bewitched by plans for an even bigger canal project, announced with great fanfare, promising so much, then stopped, then started, then stopped again. It seems the canal, allegedly three times as long and twice as deep as its Panamanian cousin, has run into deep trouble. Its financial backer and project manager, a Chinese billionaire, hit badly by Chinese stock market drops late last year. This project's had a roller coaster public ride, initially captivating Nicaraguans with all sorts of lofty economic growth promises, now facing much more organised opposition from rural Nicaraguans, angry about the destruction of their homes and protected areas should it go ahead. But the project's had the strong support of the country's president, Daniel Ortega. Now, there's a revolutionary name from the past to be reckoned with. He's running for a third consecutive term in elections early next month with his wife as vice presidential candidate. And now it's all hit US politics as well. Earlier this week, Congress passing a bill seeking to limit Ortega's access to international finance. It's quite a stew of relationships and clashes, as we'll hear now from Richard Feinberg. He's Professor of International Political Economy at the University of California, San Diego, recently returned from Nicaragua. He's fascinated by this region of the world and also has a new book out called Open for Business, The New Cuban Economy. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Nice to be with you, Geraldine.
Look, I know many listeners will be intrigued by rediscovering some details of a country that absolutely dominated our headlines in the 70s and 80s, but in many ways it's quite remote for Australians. Why does this story matter as such?
Well, of course, if in fact the Nicaragua Canal were to be built, and if it were efficient and not too expensive, presumably that could benefit Australian shippers moving their product, from Australia across the Pacific through the Nicaraguan Canal on its way either to the east coast of the United States or all the way further on to Europe. So from an international shipping point of view, if it could be done, and it's a very big if, it could have benefits for Australian trade and commerce.
And you've written that a Chinese Grand Canal in the middle of the Americas would graphically symbolise the accelerating shifts in geopolitics, which just adds another dimension to it. Why do you think the Chinese are interested in this particular project, which is obviously a risky one, given the very long-term financing required?
The Chinese government has been silent about this project. So the upfront guy is an allegedly purely private businessman who signed an agreement with the Nicaraguan government. So the Chinese government has not made clear as to whether or not, one, if it favors the project, and two, is it willing to facilitate the very large-scale financing. The numbers run from $50 billion up.
Yes, that Chinese businessman's name is Wang Jing. I gather he's pretty unknown even in China. He's the chairman and CEO of Beijing Xinwei, which is a Chinese telecoms company. You've just returned from Nicaragua. What were you able to find out about the current status of the project?
It seems to be in mothballs for the time being. People aren't talking about it that much. I can tell you for certain that there is no important construction going on. There is a lot of discussion. Maybe there's a plan B. Right, so they announced this huge, huge project, which seemed rather fanciful. They commissioned some studies, environmental studies. They never really published the results. They commissioned some commercial feasibility studies, never really published the results, raising a lot of questions. And the fact that the whole project was very non-transparent and it was shoved through the Nicaraguan legislature, this very, very important treaty, like 2 or 3 days, really appalling. Just leaves a lot of people with a lot of question marks. Well, so people think maybe this is just a little corrupt deal between some Chinese sharpies and the Ortega family.
I see.
To pocket a couple hundred million bucks each while they fantasize about a canal. The other idea is that there may be a plan B, which is even if they never build the canal, at least in our lifetime, maybe they could put in some secondary projects, a port on the Pacific, for example. Maybe a free trade zone with Chinese factories, maybe a train running partly through the country, so that the Nicaraguans would see at least something come out of this. That's a much rumored plan B.
I read that actually speculating about the state of the canal project has become a real national pastime.
Yeah. Well, they did do some surveys of land where the canal might be constructed. And that aroused a lot of opposition from people living in those areas because the government was not clear as to exactly how they would go about expropriating any lands and compensating. What would be the terms of compensation? The government handled it very poorly, and so it generated an opposition from just people along the pathway. Hey, what's going on here? Are we about to lose our lands? And how much are you going to pay us?
Mm. And tell us about the Russians' involvement, because there's a quite fetching picture of Vladimir Putin with Daniel Ortega, and I think it's his wife, who's, as I said, standing for vice president. I think it's a couple of years old, this picture. It looks like he's actually on Nicaraguan soil, which is, there's some tie-up between the militaries of the two countries as well.
Yes. Well, of course, going back to the 1980s, when the Sandinistas were in power, and they did receive a lot of security assistance, including weapons and training and intelligence work with the then Soviet Union. Most of that, of course, was suspended in the 90s, but Ortega has rejuvenated some of that. So, for example, I was there recently, and the military had a public display, really very innocuous, mostly emphasized on things the military was doing to help the population, you know, disaster assistance and humanitarian projects, etc. But the equipment that they were displaying was, in many cases, Russian-made equipment, trucks, tanks, etc. Interestingly enough, in talking to the military that were manning those Russian-made equipment, they didn't seem to think very much of it one way or the other. No, it was just like equipment. No. But I think from Putin's point of view, you know, he likes to stick it to the U.S. He has this idea of sort of rejuvenating the old Russian empire. And so in that sort of fantasy on his side, renewing relations with Nicaragua, a country which has not the same sort of hostile relations with the U.S. that it had back in the 80s, but still there's a certain tension. Also, it's a more authoritarian regime these days under Ortega, and that presumably would be ideologically to Putin's liking.
Well,
so I can see him investing in a little bit to help his friend Ortega.
Well, now, getting to that whole point about sort of different styles, because this move by the House of Representatives to block the Ortega's, anything that the Americans can do to block Ortega's access to international loans, and of course he's hit back and said that this is a pattern of historic interventionist policies in our, quotes, rightful and sovereign political, social and economic processes, especially in an intensive way during electoral moments. And a lot of people might have thought, yes, well, you know, what are the Americans exactly doing?
Well, first of all, from where does sovereignty come? If sovereignty comes from the people and the government is an unconstitutional government, does the government define sovereignty or has it violated the sovereignty of its own people?
So you don't think it has a right to be there, the Ortega government? That's your view?
Well, I think there's no question it's unconstitutional. They blatantly violated the Constitution.
In the last election?
Yeah, in terms of, you know, his real, you weren't supposed to get reelected more than twice, I think, and now he's being reelected for a third time. So that was a clear violation of the, you know, in an important way. And he's just run roughshod over other institutions in Nicaragua. And he makes it very hard for the opposition. I mean, he declared his main opposition people illegitimate. They couldn't run for office. He brings lawsuits against them. No, he's definitely with strong-arm tactics. So setting that aside, I think what the Congress said was that the U.S. should vote against loans from the multilateral institution. You know, every country has the right to vote as it wants in the executive board of the World Bank and the IMF and the IDB, right? But even if the U.S. votes no, chances are the loans will be approved. Particularly in the World Bank and the IDB, the United States does not have a majority. And so long as other countries approve the loans, U.S. opposition would not be decisive.
So, because Ortega's a very wily character, as people have noticed that, you know, whether a lot of the other leftist leaders, Bolivia, Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, Ecuador, they've all gone the way of populists, I suppose. But he's there. He's not showing any signs of going. What do you think we should imagine will happen at these elections of November, I think, aren't they?
Yes. Well, certainly he'll be re-elected. There seems to be no question about that. He is popular. One always therefore asks, why does he adapt these strong-arm tactics when he could actually win a legitimate and democratic election. And that has to do with, I think, the psychology of himself and his wife and their experiences. They lost certain elections, and they want to be absolutely sure that doesn't happen to them ever again. But he has been clever in the sense that he learned from mistakes that his enemies has made in the 1980s. But back then, they railed against the capitalists. They seized their properties. Nothing like that these days. He has very good relations with the local business sector. He also basically had good relations with international investors. And he's had good relations with the World Bank and the IMF and the Inter-American Development Bank. At the same time, at least up until recently, he was able to bring in money from Chavez and his buddies in Venezuela. So that gave him enough money to sprinkle some goodies to his basic supporters. So he gave them, for example, improved roofing for their homes. Mm. Small things, maybe to you and me, but meaningful to your average, sort of working class Nicaraguan. So he's been politically very astute, keeping his popular base satisfied that he's paying attention to their basic needs, while he's had good relations with the private sector and international investors.
Very interesting, Richard Feinberg. I'm very grateful for your time and bringing us up to date with this area that I think is a bit of a fog for many Australians. Thank you.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Richard Feinberg is from the University of California, San Diego, and his new book is out called Open for Business, The New Cuban Economy.